Hello, my name's Tamsin Westhorpe and welcome to Fresh from the Pod. I'm delighted to introduce my next guest. It's none other than the delectable garden designer James Alexander Sinclair. He has many strings to his bow, the most notable being that he's an award-winning writer, elected member of the Council of the Royal Horticultural Society, and a lead RHS judge. Now, if you thought that sounded a bit stuffy, he's far from it. He's the entertaining host that welcomes us all to Malvern Spring Festival every year. During my podcast, he shares his journey into horticulture and why he is so passionate that we should all be gardening. Good morning. I don't know if you've got up early. We're meeting in the morning on Zoom, first thing. Are you an early bird?
Okay. Today, because it's Saturday, is bread day. This is very complicated in this house, in that Celestia, my wife, makes extraordinarily wonderful sourdough bread and has done for ages. But it's quite a complicated thing. So it took up most of yesterday afternoon. And then this morning, I got up, put the oven on at 6 o'clock, went back to bed again for 15 minutes, and then we got up and went for a walk. But the walk's not allowed to last for more than 40 minutes because you have to get back.
Because the bread.
Because the bread's in the oven. Everything is governed by the bread. And so it has to be 40 minutes. We're back to take the bread out of the oven. I mean, it's worth the effort and the aggravation. It's extraordinary stuff. So yes, basically we try to get up and go for a walk at about sort of six-ish at this time of the year. And just go and wander around the place for an hour and then come back again.
That's wonderful. Because when I last came to your home, you were at Blackpitts.
Yes.
So you've moved since then. So explain what your wonderful home is like, your garden and your...
Oh, James and his lovely home.
Yes.
Basically, Blackpitts, just to go back, Blackpitts was somewhere that we lived in for 25 years, and it was in Northamptonshire. And we basically found this farmyard, which was next door to Celestia's parents' house, and built a house and built a garden. And you know, my children grew up there and all that kind of stuff. And then it got to fast forward 25 years. Garden's been lovely and marvellous. My parents-in-law then decided they need to downsize. And because the two gardens and the two houses were so very closely meshed, it didn't seem possible that somebody else should live in one half and we'd be confined. You know, it was one of those things that wasn't going to work. So we thought, right, we're going to move too, because our children had cleared off and had happily gone off to university and to work and to do all that kind of stuff. So we thought, okay, we're going to do a downsize as well. And then we did this search and thought, right, okay, we're going to be very organized about this. And this is what do we want from a house and a garden? And it was, you know, we want somewhere that's smaller but will fit everybody into it. We want somewhere possibly with a bit of woodland and a river. Something with a sunset, all of that kind of stuff. And then obviously we bought something that had none of those things.
Yeah, that's
at all.
Normal.
And not in the area that we wanted to. So we moved here. This is our fifth summer, although the first summer was basically with builders all over the place. And it's in Oxfordshire, and it's really nice, actually. One of the most important things is when we built our first house, we were sort of younger and we ran out of money, basically, because that's what happens when you do these sort of things. And so we would go through the things. And he said, say to the architect, how many radiators do we need in this room? And he'd say, four. And we'd say, can we get away with one? And so we did. So the house was freezing cold for most of the year. So we would run from the Arga in the kitchen to an electric blanket in the bed. And then
this is where I am now.
You're at that point. Yeah. You run from one to the other, and then we put a heater in the children's bathroom because we thought that was, you know, fair. And it was cold, but this house is warm. This house, we've done it, so it's all warm and nice and
it all sort of works.
No, I know. It's a pleasure and a delight. And so the garden here, when we arrived, it was again very different to Blackpitts. Blackpitts was basically an open yard. And this got sort of mature trees and, you know, it had a run of pear trees and then some birch trees. And then it had five ghastly Leylandii that I cut down almost immediately. And so it had this sort of strange framework of trees, which we hadn't had before. So we built around that, and it's a different garden. It's one I'm very fond of it. At the moment, it is a sea of poppies.
Lovely. But have you been spending, because you're a busy man, normally you're out and about, you're all over the place, have you enjoyed any aspect of being, you know, unable to do what you normally do? Have you doted on your garden?
Yes, definitely. I've doted on my garden. I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, like you, I would go from Cardiff show to Malvern to Chelsea to Chatsworth to Hampton Court to Tatton Park with, and in the meantime, I was supposed to be going to China and I was supposed to be going to Russia and, you know, all this sort of stuff, all of it gone. So you get over the disappointment of not doing all those nice things and seeing people at Chelsea and running around the place and you think, okay, well, nothing much I can do about that. I'm at home for May for the first time ever. For the whole of May, every single day, ever, yeah, pretty much every single day in this garden, and it's been a great pleasure. It's been nice to sort of watch it. It's a sort of foretaste of retirement. I'm rather enjoying it.
I can't see you retiring, but you know, it begs the question. You know, a lot of the things you do are unpaid. They're for the RHS. They're for the love of horticulture. Why do you do it? Have you had a moment where you've thought, "Am I mad that I race around the country all the time?" You know, in effect for nothing. Some people would say.
No, I mean, it is, you know, some of them I get paid for, so that's quite good.
Hurrah.
Hurrah, which is quite nice. I do it because, I mean, I don't want to come over as St. James, because I am far from St. James.
We know that.
Okay, fine. I do it because I enjoy it. And because it's nice and it's fun and I like the people who I come in contact with. And basically with the RHS, I had this sort of revelation a while ago, and I spent a lot of my time complaining about the RHS, you know, and saying they're not doing this and they're not doing that, and all the judging at Chelsea is biased and ridiculous, and you know, all that sort of harumphing. And then I made this sort of unconscious decision almost. I said, okay, well, either I can sit here and harumph, or else I can try and do something about it. And so I thought, okay, I'll try and do something about it. So I became deliberately more involved so that I would actually have some part of the decisions. And then if there was harumphing to be done, it would be entirely my fault. And so I've been doing that for quite a long time now. I first started judging in 2007, I think.
Right.
And then went on RHS Council in 2011 and have done various committee bits and charging out. And as I say, I do it partly because I'm trying to give back a little bit. But mostly because I'm having a lovely time, and charging around the place and seeing people who I like and seeing gardens and looking at things. And I'm very privileged in that I get to, you know, as you do, we get to walk on gardens and shows, and I get to go and look behind the scenes at Wisley and Bridgewater and all of these sort of things, and get to be able to sort of see what's happening with RHS communities and all of that sort of nice stuff. So I do it because I enjoy it, because that's how one tries to live one's life, is you do things because you like them.
I remember when you were sort of being voted on to council, we had to vote for you.
Yes, you did.
How terrifying was that? I mean, I remember when I was at the English Garden, we were like, oh, we must vote for James. But you think, it was part of you thinking, what if I don't get any votes?
Yes, yeah, no, it was quite scary, the whole sort of thing. You think, oh, gosh, okay, I'm putting myself up for this. What happens if nobody votes for me? What do I do? Do I just, well, I mean, I go back to harumphing, I think, probably is what I do. I go back to complaining about the whole thing. But fortunately, you did. Thank you, Tamsin.
It was entirely
due to you that I was voted on to council.
It's all my doing.
It's entirely your doing. And now, this is my ninth year. I get one more year and then that's it.
So what happens after that? Can you not rejoin, or is that it?
No, I think I've done it then. I've done 10 years. If I haven't achieved anything in those 10 years, then
tough luck,
basically. And I can't go back. I mean, hopefully I will still be involved with the RHS, and hopefully I will still do some judging for a couple of years after that. But there is a time when you need to step away. There's time we need to step back, and because if you hang on too long, it's like politicians, they never come to a good end because they hang on too long always.
Yeah.
And you need to sort of walk away and say, right, okay, I've done what I can do. Now we hand it over to somebody else. And we hand it over to possibly Tamsin becoming a member of council or something along those lines,
oh,
you know.
God, right.
Yeah, you see?
Shouldn't have interviewed you.
We pass it, and likewise with judging. There's a time when you need to sort of walk away and say, right, okay, I've done my bit and now it's up to other people to do it. Otherwise, I become that crusty old sod who I was complaining about in the first place. And so we try not to do that. So I move on and I don't know what's going to happen. What am I going to do? I don't know, I'm going to have a lot of time. I'm going to have time to do stuff here, to do more, I don't know, I'll do more, who knows? Have you got a job for me? By any chance?
Oh, I've got plenty of jobs. You won't like them, but I mean, there's jobs. There's always work here on this farm.
No, no, I like that. I was watching your film of your uncle cleaning out the pond in his wetsuit. I thought, this is good stuff. This is
absolutely
fun.
You know, but the thing is, he always rings me and says, are you free? And I think, right, the wetsuit's coming out because he can't get it off, can't get the suit off without me.
Oh, okay. Right. He can get it on, but not off.
No. And it's such an ancient suit. It's hilarious. But yeah, he's definitely entertaining. So yeah, you could end up in a pond in a wetsuit. you know, life doesn't get better than that.
It really doesn't, does it? So now, I mean, and then I've got, you know, I've got clients who are running around the place and they need attending to, and I've got lovely people I've been working for years. So, you know, you, I can't remember what your question was because it was such a long time ago and I've been drivelling ever since.
Well, it's what you would do. I mean, I've obviously judged with you, and I think what you bring to the party is entertainment. You know, it's a serious job. It's a very serious job, but you keep us all going because it's quite a long day, isn't it?
So it is quite exhausting. The whole sort of, you know, it's if you're, you know, it can be 3 days. Days of assessing standard and judging and feeding back. And it is quite intense. And it should be, people who come to do judging, yes, they take it seriously, but we should be having a nice time. And I think we do most of the time. I like the fact that, you know, you can have an argument about something with somebody, but it doesn't carry on. You go out to the next garden and you've forgotten about it. It's not, and nobody bears any grudges or nobody complains about this sort of thing. And it's good sort of spirited, back and forth, which is what it should be. It should be a lively occasion, and it should be fun and enjoyable. Because if it's not fun and enjoyable, why do we bother doing it?
Well, precisely. And the other part of your life, which is comparing at Malvern Show, you've been doing that since, I was going to say since I was at school, but that's probably not true.
That's quite rude. That's
probably very
for quite a long time. I did it. Basically, what happened is that in about 2002 or something like that, I did a television series called Small Town Gardens. Basically, there were three series of it. It was Rachel Detain presented the first one, Joe Swift presented the second one, and I presented the third one. There was no fourth one because I think I killed it dead.
Brilliant.
And if you do things like that, then people ask you to come and talk. So I was asked to go and talk by the glorious Nina Acton at Malvern. And I went down there, and it was Joe and I, and we had to give a talk in a shed. And it was most undignified, the whole thing. It was basically, it was a barn somewhere. And at the end of it, we thought, hang on, we can do better than this. We should just, so Nina and Joe and I started plotting. And then we started building theatres, and it all became much more exciting and more sort of, you know, through the Malvern, the times I've done Malvern, we've had a circus theme, which means we've had acrobats. We've had a fashion show theme, which means that we dressed up the whole of the Gardeners World presenting team in sort of weird clothing. Joe Swift had to wear a suit made of astroturf. At one point, I co-presented with a 6-foot transvestite called Sabrina. Which is not something you usually find at RHS shows, basically. So that's been quite jolly. So yes, now I've done that for quite a long time, and I've compared at Gardeners World Live for quite a long time, and then I've done it at Hampton Court before. You know, I tart about on stages is one of the things that I do.
It's something that I love to do, and I'm definitely not as accomplished as you. Do you get nervous? Because I mean, I really do before I go on stage, but you don't seem to, or are you just hiding the nerves?
I don't tend to get nervous. I think there's a sort of moment, the 5 minutes before, you're sort of walking around saying, okay, da, 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 da. But I tend to just wing it and just go on there and just say what comes into my head at that time and show off, basically. I'm appalling and ghastly show off, and I put my hands up to that now. And I like tarting around on stages. And so that's what I do quite a lot of.
But don't you think that if you come, I mean, I'm learning. I do, you know, loads of talks, and it really, you do learn your craft. It's, you've just got to keep doing it, haven't you? But the more you prepare, in some instances, the worse it can be, because you've got in your mind, this is what I want to accomplish. And then you meet the audience and you suddenly realize that they're not the sort of people that are going to respond to that. So I think it's an art form, isn't it? It's learning to look at your audience and think, oh no, hang on, throw that out the window. This is
A certain amount. I mean, if you've spent a long time putting pictures together and stuff like that, you know which way you're going, you know what you're going to do, you know how it's going to work. The secret, I think, is that you have to make your audience laugh within the first 22 seconds.
Yes.
Because then they'll understand that it's okay to have a jolly time, and you're not going to be there and give them a serious university style lecture. We're all going to have a nice evening, and it's going to be fun. So you try and do that as quickly as you can to just put them at their ease. You know, you talk about gardens. People have come to listen to stories about gardens, because what every talk is about a story. And every garden that I've ever done has a story behind it, and has, you know, how did this happen? What things happened as it went along? And so you tell the story of the garden and how it developed and how it came from one thing to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next, and how it came to what it is, as it is now. And so you're sort of showing pictures of its progress, and each sort of bit. I mean, it depends. So you've got your sort of village hall audience, and then you've got your garden show audience, who basically some of them come along and then they stand up and they walk on because they're going, they can move through and carry on.
And so actually, I've learned, you probably have as well, if someone falls asleep or if they walk out, you just have to, you can't take that to heart, because everyone's got different needs.
Absolutely. I'll tell you, one of the interesting things that happens is that quite often you have a couple that come to a garden talk, and one of them wants to be there much more than the other one does. And it's almost invariably, he tends to fall asleep sometimes. And what I do occasionally is suddenly talk very loudly next door to them. And that wakes them up. And they sort of go, okay, fine. But if they want to have a snooze, then they can have a snooze. That's fair. I judge a successful lecture and the fact that nobody throws anything. If nobody throws anything, you get to the end of that. And if nobody falls asleep, then that's a triumph, basically. So you get to the end of that and you think, okay, I've done that. That's fine. But I like talking to people, and I like sort of going out and meeting people, and I like tarting around on stages, like I say. That's sort of how it works.
Well, you're very good at it.
Thank you.
Now, talking about gardens, you mentioned that every garden has a story, and a garden that you've been involved in that has a hell of a story is Horatio's garden. How did you get involved with that? I mean, these gardens are created in hospitals for people that have had incredible accidents, and they need that outside space so desperately. How did you get involved?
I was asked, and I try and make a rule that if people ask me to do things, I say yes, usually before I think. No, it sometimes gets you in trouble, but not in this case. In this case, it's been a delight. So basically, Horatio's Garden was begun after a boy called Horatio Chappell was very tragic. He killed by a polar bear while on a school trip, and in his memory, his parents set up this charity called Horatio's Garden, because Horatio, just before he died, he wanted to become a doctor, and he'd done a certain amount of sort of research and holiday work and things like that before he went off to university to study medicine. And one of the things that he'd done is he'd done a survey at the spinal unit in Salisbury. That involved us, talking to the patients, finding out what they would like. And the overwhelming thing that they wanted was some sort of outside space, some sort of garden that they could go into. So when he died, his parents set up this charity to do precisely that, to do precisely what Horatio had envisioned, which is to put a garden in every spinal injury unit in the country, of which there are 11. And so Salisbury was the first one, and Cleve did that. Cleve West did that one. And then the next one to come up was in Glasgow. And Olivia Chappell, Horatio's mother, very sweetly rang me and said, would you like to do this? I'm sure that Cleve had some influence on that probably as well. And the fact that I have a Scottish name may have helped slightly. Wow. So I flew up to Glasgow to go and look at this place. And it was deeply depressing. And it was, it was one of a sort of classic drippy, wet Scottish day. And it was sort of concrete and You know those sort of shrubs that you find are outside supermarkets that have been pruned by somebody with a machine, and they just there's a whole load of Lanisa and Nitida that have been carved into amorphous blobs, and then a lot of sort of rat poison and all this sort of thing. And then right next door to this garden was the main road that goes into the Clyde Tunnel, and so this was the garden that I was given, and I remember sitting there thinking, wow. Okay. And then I thought, okay, right, we do this. And it all sort of came together. And the team, the sort of fundraising team, and Olivia are wonderful. And there's Catherine in Scotland, who's extraordinary. And they put the money together to do this. And one of the wonderful things about Horatio's Garden is that, yes, Horatio's Garden is not just a garden. It's actually it's a commitment. In that the charity employs a head gardener, and we have volunteers, and we commit to looking after it for the next 25 years or however long the NHS will give us a lease for. So you know, you've seen lots of gardens in hospitals and schools where there's a lot of initial enthusiasm, and then the nurse or the teacher or something who initiated it leaves, and then it sort of basically fades away. This won't happen with Horatio's Gardens. These are gardens that have had quite a lot of money invested in them, so that they're actually looking pretty darn good every single day of the year, because they are a lifeline.
Do you go and have you revisited to see patients using the space?
Yes. Yeah. Now, I try to go 3 or 4 times a year. I would like to go more, because it is. I have an extraordinary emotional connection with this garden, more so than any other garden that I've ever made, I think, probably, because this is a garden. Okay, so most of my life is making gardens for nice people who can afford to have their gardens designed, and they live in nice places, and it's lovely for their family and for their friends and all that kind of stuff, but it doesn't actually change their lives. This is a gardens. Horatio's Gardens change people's lives, and they change them visibly, and they change them obviously, and they change them quickly. I remember the moment. Basically, we had to access the garden. Part of the garden is a courtyard, and the only way to get into it was by building a sort of sterile tunnel through the middle of the ward, in order for us to take diggers and sand and everything through this. And then we took that away, and suddenly there was this garden there that nobody really realized that was there. And then the patients would sort of come out and would walk into it, the sort of mood and the vibe in the ward changed almost instantly. Okay. Suddenly there were plants. Suddenly there was a place for people to go. Because one of the most powerful parts of creating that garden was talking to a woman whose husband had been there for quite a long time. And she said that the worst thing is that if we wanted to cry, we had to go and shut ourselves in the broom cupboard, because there was no privacy in this place. There's no privacy in a hospital. All there is curtains around a bed. And this is something that happened to you that is a life-changing thing. And you have to have time in order to adapt, in order for you to adapt, in order for your family to adapt, in order for your friends to adapt. I mean, just imagine that you are paralyzed and you can't go home because there's 2 steps that get up into your front door. So every single aspect of your life has changed, and that involves a certain amount of conversation. It involves invariably an awful lot of grief and talk. And so there was nowhere to go to do that. So one of the most important things in the garden is that we made these sort of pods where people could actually go and sit and talk and cry and laugh and be part of the garden at the same time. So it is. It's a very emotional garden, and it's a garden that doesn't just benefit one family and their friends. It benefits hundreds of people, and over its lifetime, it will benefit thousands of people. Not just the patients, but their visitors, their mothers, their wives, their husbands, their children, their grandchildren, everything, and the doctors and the nurses and the staff there.
So, would you say that's your proudest achievement?
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely, without any hesitation. It is. I think that if you speak to any of us who have been lucky enough to design Horatio's Garden, so that's Cleve and Joe Swift and me and Bunny Guinness and Tom Stuart Smith's doing one at the moment, and Sarah Price is the next one on the list. If you talk to any of us, I haven't missed anybody off, have I? No, that's it. If you talk to any of us, we will all say the same thing, is that this is a really, really important thing to be involved in. And it goes wider than that. It's not just about those gardens and that charity. It's the fact that plants and gardens make a difference to people's lives. And we're seeing that during lockdown anyway. And it can change you, not just your mental health, your physical health, your general well-being, and all that kind of stuff. You know this. All of us who are involved in gardens, this sort of big revelation that plants and gardens are good for your mental health that has been quite fashionable for the last couple of years.
Frustrating in a way, because you think, where have you been?
We've known this for ages, and it's really, really nice when people begin to sort of catch up. And if you get to do, you know, like doing gardens for health and well-being at Wisley, the one that Matt Keat is doing there at the moment, the ones that we've done at Chelsea Flower Show, and the things that we do at Horatio's and places like that, it's more and more people begin to understand because they see it happening. And you can sort of see, right, you go into here, the gardens at the Maggie centres, you know, all of these things, they make a big difference. And the more people that see it, the more that there are, the more obvious it will become to people who aren't, you know, gardeners. I mean, you and I, we wake up in the morning and we think about gardens. Not everybody does that.
No. I don't understand genuinely how people live if they have no interest in gardening. It really concerns me. Like, what do you do? I would. The thing is, I'd be in danger if I didn't garden. I would spend so much money on shoes. I'd be shopping all the time.
Like, there are more things than just gardening and shoes in life, I think.
Are there? Well.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things. You know, there's food.
Food is a big one. Yeah.
And all of that, but no, I know what you mean. You are most probably like me, in that people say to me, "said okay, so what do you do when you're not gardening?" To which the answer is, "I garden."
Yeah.
You know, weekends I'm gardening all week for people, and then I come home, and my greatest pleasure is to basically go out there and weed a border, or poodle around and do that sort of thing.
But what do you do? So say you're meeting with other amazing garden designers such as yourself, such as Tom Stuart Smith, Cleve. What do you talk about? Do you all talk about gardening? Or do you think, right, no, that, you know, because I don't know.
But mostly we gossip about other garden designers. Yes, we talk about gardens. We talk about all sorts of everything. I mean, if you're bumping into people at a show, then you tend to talk about what you're looking at. You know, it's that kind of thing. I think that we're all sort of, you know, caught by the same obsession, which is basically we love plants, we love gardens. We're lucky enough. What it is basically is that we are lucky enough to make our livings doing something that we love, which is a huge privilege to be able to do that. And I think that's the position that we're all in. But most of the time, basically we're gossiping scurrilously about other people who, God, did you see so-and-so? That's God. Wasn't that dreadful? Or wasn't that awful? Or isn't it wonderful that so-and-so has done that? Or have you heard about Tamsin? It's what we say a lot, actually, an awful lot. Yeah.
What's she doing now? Oh, dear. I mean, I remember coming to you at Black Pits, and I might be dreaming this because this does happen to me. Did you have aspirations to be an actor at one point?
Yes, I did. I did. I wanted to be an actor when I left school. Basically, when I was at school and I had the benefit of an extraordinarily privileged and expensive education that I slightly squandered because I didn't really do any work at all, and I was considered to be not university material, because, you know, it was odd in those days.
You think that's bad? I was considered to not be A-level material.
Oh, well, then you see, that's it. That's what sort of happens sometimes. We are undiscovered geniuses. So I thought I'd go to drama school instead, and so I did these auditions, and I didn't get it, and then I didn't do it. I should have gone back and done it the next year, but I went off and behaved badly in London instead, and did a whole series of weird and odd jobs, and had no interest at all in gardening. Gardening was not anything at all. So I wanted to be a photographer, or I wanted to be. What I wanted to be is I wanted to be a genius. But I wasn't actually prepared to do any work to become a genius at all. I wanted to be someone would come up to me in the street and say, "Oh my goodness, you're amazing! Come and write poetry, or you know, come and be a rock singer, or come and be a film star, or something along those lines." But it didn't sort of happen like that. So I actually ended up selling jeans and being a waiter. I was a good waiter actually, and I did a lot of washing up. I washed up in a nightclub in High Street, Kensington, in London, called Regine's, and I was basically the kitchen porter. And they had these slightly irascible French chefs, and they cooked using big copper saucepans. And so these big copper saucepans then had to be washed, and then they had to be polished with lemon juice and salt before they went back on the shelf again. So this grumpy Frenchman called Jean-Yves or something like that would appear at the door and throw a saucepan at us. And he was here, poof, and the saucepan would fly. You have to try and catch this hot saucepan, get it in the water, get it polished, get it sorted. Then he would then go out and dirty it again and then chuck it back at you later.
Do you know, we have a cafe at Stocktonbury, and I am useless out the front because I try and sort of do a bit of everything. So we've all had to do barista training, and my sister's all a whiz at all this. And I get in a panic, or I start talking to people about gardens and the queue builds up and everyone gets really annoyed with me. So they chuck me in the back to wash up.
Yeah.
And I actually love it because I feel safe there. No one's going to ask me any foodie things. I'm just on my own. But you're right. These chefs, they you clean it. Next minute, it's there again.
Yeah, it's filthy again. And so our sort of compensation for the whole thing is that the glasses used to come through, and we used to polish off the dregs of the customers' drinks. And so by the end of it, we were quite drunk. Because that was, and our shift finished at 4 o'clock in the morning. So it was quite a sort of serious thing. So yes, basically I did a load of washing up, but I wanted to be an actor. And what's weird about life generally is that things sort of come round in the end. And so that's sort of what I do when I'm sort of comparing or giving out prizes or tarting about generally on stages, is that I've come full circle and I am basically being an actor. I am performing. So I've got that bit, and I've also got the comfort of actually falling in love and finding gardening somewhere along the way.
Yeah. And were your parents gardeners, or did you grow up with any horticultural influence?
No, my parents were quite keen gardeners actually, but that was something boring that your parents did. Why would I want to do something like that? It's sort of dull. And I was pressed into doing various bits of gardening occasionally, but I worked out that if I did it really, really badly, no one would ask me a second time, and I could go off and smoke cigarettes and pretend to be Oscar Wilde instead, which was obviously my destiny and my desire. So they were, you know, they were keen gardeners. My father grew vegetables. My mother grew sort of flowers and stuff. But I had no interest in it whatsoever. Why would I want to do something like that?
In a way, you saying that's quite comforting, because, you know, my son's 14 and you know, he rolls his eyes when I say, come and help me in the garden. It's like torture. So yeah. There is hope that these teens may catch the bug.
It's quite interesting because my children obviously were brought up with gardens. I have three children, and they, you know, they watched us gardening. They didn't do very much gardening. But it sort of rubs off somewhere, and they now are all quite interested. My eldest son, has a really nice garden. He has a sort of rented flat in London, and he's done a lot for the garden there. And he sort of rings up and says, "Look at this, and I've done this, and isn't this amazing?" And he sends pictures of his vegetables to Celestria and all of this kind of stuff. So it sort of, it gets into them in the end. And they get it. My younger son also has a sort of rented garden. He's been doing a lot of gardening during lockdown and things. My daughter is a phenomenal pastry chef, but she uses a lot of flowers in what she does. So it is there. So do not despair. But there's also the possibility that your son may not be interested in gardening. He may go off and do something much, much more exciting.
He's like you. He wants to be an actor.
Then encourage him. Let him go off and do that. Yeah. And it's you know, being an actor is very difficult. My father, oddly, who was a soldier, he wasn't too averse to the fact of me doing an act, of me being an actor. There was one point in my life when I said, well, I don't know what I'm going to do. Maybe I should join the army, Dad. And that suggestion, all the blood drained from his face. He said,
I can't.
Please, please, please don't do that.
A complete liability.
No. It was being a really, really, really bad idea, and so I didn't do that one.
But you know, I was thinking the other day because my son said to me, "Mum, you know, what did you want to be?" And I was telling him about we used to have these work experience people coming in trying to place you for a week, and I said I wanted to be a gardener, and they just looked at me like I was crazy, and they gave me the option of the army or a beauty therapist.
Do you think that's where we are? We're somewhere between being in the army and a beauty therapist. That's where gardening fits.
Well, I don't know. It's worrying.
It's quite weird.
You know, just going back to the future of horticulture, really, because of your work with the RHS, and everybody's sort of interested in gardening now, thankfully, and it's rescued a lot of people through this lockdown. Do you think that people are going to remain interested, or do you think, you know, after lockdown, people are going to go back to what they used to do? What's your sort of gut feeling?
I think that people, I don't know, who knows what's going to happen? So many things have sort of changed. I think that once you're hooked on gardening, you will always come back to it. It may not be quite as intense as it has been, because people won't have the time. They will have other things to do. They will have places to go. They will have, you know, holidays to go on. They will have friends to see. They will have all of this sort of stuff. So if you think about the amount of time that you spend, you know, talking to people or meeting people or traveling from A to B, and all that time has been, I've been put by those of us who are lucky enough to have gardens, which is quite a sort of small percentage of the country anyway, has been put into gardening. So I don't think that anybody will garden to the same intensity in their own gardens as they have done this year. I mean, if everything goes back to normal next year, I physically will not have the time to do as much weeding as I have done this year. So therefore the garden will look nice, but it won't look quite as good as it did at that moment. So I think that, we've had a lot of people who've discovered gardening during this time. And I think that that's exciting, and some of them will carry on, and some of them won't. I think that our lives will hopefully change a bit after this. It was kind of depressing if we just all went back to as it was before. I think that a lot of issues have been raised over the last few months. I think that, the whole coronavirus thing has made people think much more than perhaps they did. I think that there's also the Black Lives Matter, and the fact that we need to look carefully at diversity within horticulture, which is not good on a number of different levels. So I think that people have had time to think, and they've had time to think about professional horticulture. They've had time to think about what the horticulture industry should look like. I think that amateur gardeners have had the chance to find comfort in gardens and comfort in growing things. So I think it's a weird time for all of us.
I've been thinking, obviously, having an open garden, we're not open at the moment, but I've been thinking, gosh, you know, if we lose all our coaches, you know, we may not get our retired groups that come and keep us afloat. We've got to reinvent who we are. We've got to work like Billy-O to get younger people through the door. So yeah. I think there'll be a lot of that. So there'll be people like me, you know, on an individual level that thinking outside the box, which will change things gradually over time, because you've got to, haven't you, to survive. You've got to get.
Yeah, no, we have to. I mean, I think that the future of horticulture and it lies in the next generation, and lies in education. And a lot of what the RHS does in schools and in communities, hopefully will pay off at some point. Because, you know, we're teaching an awful lot of, of children, the benefits of gardening and where food comes from, and all of this sort of stuff. The sort of stuff that I never got. I was never part of a school curriculum when I was at school. It was never really part of a school curriculum when my children were at school either. So it's something that is spreading, and it's trying to sort of make things more inclusive and more diverse, and make gardening and horticulture for more people, rather than, you know, your core membership, your core visitor, the RHS core membership is, you know, 50 plus white middle class people. And gardening is not just for us. Gardening should be for anybody and everybody.
What I love about you, and I must mention that you were Journalist of the Year last year for the Garden Media Guild.
I was.
Yes, so that's wonderful, because what I love about your writing style is it's very inclusive. I mean, you have the knowledge, you know what you're doing, but you chat to people on a very human level. And I think, like, looking at your blogs, they're funny. And I think that's really important, that horticulture is presented in a way that is not daunting.
It needs to be appealing, basically, is what we're trying to do. I mean, you know, I like writing, and I like sort of trying to find an angle on it. But there is this sort of and always has been this thing. It's you know, horticultural Latin and all this sort of thing. It's quite a sort of barrier, and you think, oh, if I don't know the name of a plant, then I can't play this game.
Yeah.
Well, actually, you know, I spend my life forgetting the names of plants.
So do I.
And you know, even things that I know. And quite a lot of my early life was my knowledge was based on the fact that if somebody asked me a question, they didn't know what the answer is. Therefore, I could say anything and they would believe me. So if they say, what's that plant? And I say, oh, that's Tamsin Westhorpia. Then they say, oh, how marvellous. And they're not going to say, actually, they're not going to call me out and say, actually, you're wrong. Because, you know, so you can get away with quite a lot through bluffing. But it is gardening. The most important thing about gardening is that gardening is supposed to be fun.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be enjoyable.
That is the key message. That's what I think, you know, you bring, and people like Anne-Marie Powell bring. It's got to be inclusive. We've got to speak to people in a language that doesn't daunt you. Because like you say, I meet people that visit the garden who are real plantsmen, and I'm terrified. I just go into meltdown and I think, crikey Moses, I can't get involved with this conversation. And that should not be the case, should it?
No, it shouldn't. I mean, it doesn't really matter what, you know. One of the things that I have learned over the last however many years I've been doing this, the first 30, 40, 40, God, nearly 40 years, is that, no, it can't be 40 years. It must be 35. Anyway, I'm not that old quite yet, is that you can learn something from a gardener, no matter whether they have been gardening for 100 years or 100 minutes. They will, each and everybody has some sort of form of knowledge that they can share with anybody. So obviously there are those of us doing it for a while who know a fair amount of stuff and can answer most questions about other things, but we can also learn something from some people who've, you know, had their first garden this summer and they've discovered something and you think, oh, that's quite interesting. So it is, gardening is a conversation, and it involves everybody listening. Basically, so we as experienced gardeners should be listening to first timers and to people who are just starting to do it, just as much as people are listening to us give them wise advice about slugs again for the 97th time, and all of that. So it is a conversation. All good things should be conversations, and it should be sort of back and forth, and all of us can learn something from everybody else.
But I've discovered during lockdown that if you look at Instagram and Twitter and everything, everyone's relaxed a bit more. So everyone's just saying what they do, or how about trying this, you know, whereas before I think people were like, oh gosh, what's the correct answer? We've all sort of just gone, oh, right, this is what I'm doing. It's worked. You try it. So I think that's a really positive thing from this time.
I think it's definitely a good thing. It's sort of interesting because if you look at it from, if you look at it from the RHS point of view, for example, it's just the RHS's job to teach the correct way to do something. Yes. And it's important that we have a benchmark.
Absolutely.
There. Okay. But what's the important thing to remember is that correct way to do something is not the only way to do something. So the RX is saying, right, in order to prepare this bed, you should be doing this, you should be doing that, you should be doing the other. But the more you do it, you sort of work out shortcuts and think, well, this works better for me. And instead of doing this, I can do this in this order. And you still end up with the end result, which is a plant that is alive, because that's basically what you're after. So people are sort of saying, you know, the RHS, the way that they do it is too sort of rigid. It has to be there, and everybody else could just go up. But what we need to make sure that people understand that this is not the only way. There are other ways of doing it. Go off and find a way of doing it yourself. What's the worst thing that could happen? The worst thing that happened is that you could murder a petunia, which, you know, plants are not puppies. It's absolutely fine to chuck them on the compost heap if you feel like it, or eat them, or do something along those lines. So it is, yes, there is the correct way, but it is not the only way. Just go forth, have fun. The minute that you are gardening and find that it is a chore and a pain, and you go out of your back door and think, oh, do I really have to do this? Then stop doing it. Then do something else. Go and take up kayaking or mountain climbing or cooking or do something else. Don't feel that you are forced into being a gardener. And so if you have that slightly more relaxed attitude, then hopefully you will find that actually you just do the bits that you like doing, the bits you enjoy doing. Nobody has ever been arrested for having weeds in their garden. It's fine. If you've got weeds in your garden, it's okay. People will come and give you a hard time if there are weeds in your garden at Stoltonbury. Obviously,
they do.
But they also quite enjoy finding that. Yeah.
Oh, did you know there's a dandelion in the long borders?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what they want to do. Because one of the reasons why people go visit gardens is to find bits of gardens that are open to the public that are not as good as theirs. So this long conversation where I said, I saw the roses at Stoltonbury, but they weren't quite as nice as yours, were they? No, mine are a bit better than that. You know, it's that kind of thing. People like that. They enjoy, if gardeners aren't gardening, then they like to go and visit other gardens, or they like to sort of talk to other gardeners. And that's what makes it a big sort of sociable party, really.
And let's hope that continues. Well, James, thank you so much for joining me on Fresh from the Pod.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for asking me.
Inspiration. And I hope next year we'll see you tripping the light fantastic on the stages of many shows. Let's hope that...
We hope that everything happens. I've got to actually go and trip the light fantastic next week at the Moscow Flower Show, virtual Moscow, which means me cavorting on Zoom in front of various Russians doing some sort of thing like that. So there is some sort of show life that is going on at some places in some parts of the world, but it's sort of slightly different. But thank you very much indeed for having me here, and thank you very much to Condit, who I'm still not quite sure what they do, but I know I gave them a prize at the Garden Media Guild, and I downloaded their app and I looked at it. It seems to be most exciting, all sorts of lovely things happening.
And it's a good place for beginners, I think.
Excellent place for beginners, and very good of them to allow you to sort of have a lovely time talking to lots of people, because it's like I said the other day, you rang me up to ask me to do this and I was already listening to one of your podcasts.
I know, and I just love it. It's wonderful just chatting to people.
It's very nice. It's good. Well, thank you very much. Brilliant. Indeed for having me.
Thank you, James.
Thanks.
If you hadn't come across James before, then I'm pretty convinced that you will have been won over by his charm and wit after our conversation. Thank you, James, and I hope you continue to sparkle stardust over the gardening world. Until next time, happy gardening.
Fresh from the Pod is presented by me, Tamsin Westhorpe, and produced by Candide in their plant-filled Bristol office. Candide is a free plant and gardening app with a helpful community of plant lovers, interesting articles and great tools like plant identification and garden tours. Ask a question in the app with the hashtag #FreshFromThePod and I'll choose my favourite to answer later in the series. And if you enjoyed Fresh from the Pod, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, share it on Reddit and talk about it with your friends. And don't forget to subscribe.